My name is James McNellis. I'm a developer on the Visual C++ team at Microsoft, and I'm going to talk a bit this afternoon about some of the new features that we added in Visual C++ 2013, so the release that came out in October of last year, plus a handful of things that we've been working on since then and have also released. So as a bit of an agenda, we'll look at a few of the new features that we added to support Windows 8.1 app development. I know there's been a whole bunch of talks so far the past 2 days on this subject, so we won't go into too much detail. We'll look at some of the performance improvements that we've made, both for optimizations and for some of the libraries that we have. We'll look at some of the new C++ 11 and C++ 14 language features that we've implemented in the compiler, some of the improvements we've made to the libraries that we ship with the tools, and then look at a bunch of the productivity and other improvements that we've made to the editor and IDE. So to start with Windows 8.1, at Build a couple of weeks ago, it was announced that we have a new type of project in Visual Studio called Universal Apps. And basically, these are apps that run both Windows Store. They can be built for both Windows Store and Windows Phone from the same set of project data. So this is enabled for Visual C++, just like it is for the other languages for which you can build Windows Store apps. There were a bunch of improvements made in the XAML designer, especially performance-related for this last release. Actually, before I joined the Visual C++ team a couple years ago, I worked on the XAML designer as we did all the initial work to try and get things up and running for Windows 8 Windows Store apps. And so performance dogged us for a long time, so I was quite impressed when I went to go play with it a bit before this talk. It's quite impressive how much faster it is than in Visual Studio 2012. So in addition to performance improvements, though, there's new and updated templates to make it easier to build apps without having to do a whole bunch of boilerplate on your own. There's a bunch of new controls in Windows 8.1. The designer now supports rulers and dynamic guides, and you can now do in-place editing of controls in the Blend designer. So whereas you used to have to open up controls elsewhere, now you can actually do it in the context in which they're actually used, which can help make it easier to design them. We have some new graphics debugging techniques if you're using DirectX for your app. We introduced in Visual Studio 2012 some new abilities to debug DirectX graphics. In 2013, we've improved these. We've improved the performance of some of these debugging tools. And we've also enabled you to capture from remote machines, which is really important for Windows Store apps especially. And we've added support for compute shader debugging. We have some new tools also for diagnostics. Some of the most important tools here are for memory profiling, for being able to figure out where memory is being allocated and used, for CPU profiling to figure out what parts of your app are actually causing your app to run slowly. The energy profiler is very important for any kind of mobile apps because you can find out, maybe you're not using much CPU, but you happen to be doing a lot of periodic work very quickly, so you're preventing the CPU from going to sleep. So this can help you identify that kind of issue. We also have a number of debugger improvements. One of them that's been available for managed debugging for a while is Just My Code, so you can have the debugger not step into library code or library components. We've added a bunch of new features for improving async debugging, so for debugging tasks to figure out how tasks respond and where they're running, plus the ability to debug ARM crash dumps. I don't know if anybody here has used the C++ CX language extensions. So these are a set of language extensions that we designed to make it easier to interoperate with Windows, with WinRT components and to build Windows Store apps using C++. So there's a few new features there in this release. One of them is there are now basically nullable types for structs. So you can, for example, here you can use iBox, and so that age can hold either an int or it can hold a null, no value. It's not possible to override the toString, so you can actually change what your object gets rendered as a string, which is very useful for debugging because the debugger will let you to display that. We made a bunch of improvements to WinRT exception handling. So at the WinRT ABI layer, there are no exceptions. Basically, when you throw an exception in C++, we catch it at the ABI layer and translate it into an H result and then pass it across the ABI because it's a COM ABI. When you throw the exception, though, you have the ability to provide extra information. So obviously, there's a call stack associated with the exception, and you can provide a string. In Visual Studio 2012, we actually just discarded a lot of that information at the boundary where we caught the exception, and we've changed that now so that we can pass the extra information along with the error code. This can help debugging a lot. We've also made a bunch of performance improvements, and there's more coming. So some of the performance improvements that we've already done are related to making ref classes smaller. So we've made enhancements there. And then to make it possible to instantiate them faster. So we've made a bunch of improvements to the support libraries so that we have to do less work to instantiate types. We also implemented, on the libraries team, we added some new features to the collections that we have. So just like there's StudVector and StudMap in C++, we have platform vector and platform unordered map and types like that that implement the WinRT interfaces so you can use them across the ABI. So we made a bunch of improvements to that. We added support for initializer lists to those, and we'll take a look at initializer lists a bit later in this talk because we've also added that support to the standard library containers. And we've also added some additional validation of template parameters. So whereas a bunch of invalid uses of these types would have failed, you know, with arcane template errors before, we now give them nice concise errors. At Build last year, one of my colleagues, Sridhar, gave a talk on C++ CX best practices. So if you're using C++ CX, I definitely recommend that you watch that talk. So that's kind of a wrap-up of all the new Windows 8.1 features that we've added. We've also done a bunch of work. Obviously, every release, we do a bunch of work to improve our ability to optimize code and to improve the performance within our libraries. So just a short recap of you know, the optimization process. So the most basic optimizations are to enable optimizations in the compiler. So when you compile code, you set the O2 flag to say, you know, optimize this code for speed. And the compiler will see the C++ files, it'll optimize the code into the object files, and then you'll link them together into your executable. But there's no inlining across those object files. So, you know, every object file is independent. When they get linked together by the linker, there's no further optimizations to see, you know, what can be, you know, it'll discard unused things, but it can't actually go and look and see, oh, these things are very similar, we should put them together. So to solve that problem, you know, the second stage is whole program optimization. And basically, the way whole program optimization works is, you know, you still compile your C++ files, and, you know, the compiler still does some optimization. But most of the actual code generation, most of the actual optimization doesn't happen until link time. So basically, we start up the compiler backend that does optimization during the link, and we go and optimize all of the code as if it was in one giant object file together, which enables us to do inlining across objects. It allows us to do better code elimination. It allows us to do better devirtualization of function calls. So finally, you know, that's all well and good, but statically, there's no way for us to tell, you know, which code paths are more likely or less likely to be executed. So there's no way for us to look at the code statically and say, we should, you know, group all this code together because it's very unlikely that, you know, this stuff is going to be called. So for example, error handling code on, you know, extremely rare errors, you know, in general, that's never actually going to be executed. So we want to group that together to reduce the number of pages required in memory for code and to, you know, to make the code more cache friendly. So since we can't do that statically, we have what we call profile-guided optimizations. And the way these work is, you know, you go through the same compile link step with O2 and GL to produce your executable. You then run a whole bunch of training scenarios. So you basically come up with, these are common uses of my code. These are how the code is commonly used. And this generates count data, so we actually count the number of times, you know, each individual expression gets evaluated, each statement gets executed. And then we feed that back into a second compilation and link pass in which we take that data into account and we decide, hey, all of these functions, you know, are very frequently called, so let's do extra work to optimize them for speed. And, oh, the rest of these functions are not actually called so frequently. In general, you know, the number of functions that we actually need to compile for maximum speed is only a couple of percent. Like, most of the time that you spend, you know, that your app spends executing, it's executing, you know, tight loops or you know, very small amounts of the total amount of code. So, you know, our recommendation is certainly if you know to use profile guided optimization if you can. A couple of guys who work on the compiler backend wrote some articles on our blog, and I'll have a link to that at the end. So it can be a bit tricky to set up at first. It can be a bit tricky to come up with, you know, what good training scenarios are. But if you can do that, you can actually get fairly substantial performance gains from your software. So traditionally, you know, your CPU has an ALU, you know, that does, you know, one instruction at a time. You can do one add and then one multiply, et cetera. And, you know, for the last probably 15 years, most CPUs have also had vector units that are capable of doing multiple operations at once. We have, in Visual Studio 2012, we added a new feature to the compiler called auto-vectorization. So the compiler will actually identify different, you know, patterns in your code that it can take that code and then actually generate calls that use those vector units automatically. So, for example, if you have a loop like this one presented here, where you're just iterating over, you know, a bunch of elements in a set of arrays, it can go and generate vector instructions to, you know, do four additions at once instead of doing single additions at once. In Visual Studio 2012, you know, we did a lot of the infrastructure work for this. We made a lot of common scenarios work, but there were a lot of things that you know, we couldn't vectorize still. So we'll look at a couple specific cases, you know, in a bit. But, you know, here's a list of some of the new features that we've added. And these are specific cases that are extremely beneficial. So in the STL, you know, if you're working with a std vector and you're passing it to, you know, one of the standard library algorithms, basically what this ends up getting optimized down to is we end up with pointer loops. So, you know, we use a pointer as an iterator, and we iterate over the elements in the vector. In Visual Studio 2012, we could not automatically vectorize these pointer loops, and we can now in Visual Studio 2013. So if you're making heavy use of the standard library algorithms, this will be of, you know, substantial benefit. We've also come up with, we also now have the ability to vectorize even where there are no loops. So in this second example, you know, there's no loop here, but we're doing four division operations on elements in an array. So we can say, hey, we know, you know, that we can do all four of these in parallel in the vector unit. We've also added a new feature. So C++ has a bunch of calling conventions. We've added a new one called vector call. So one of the problems with the existing calling conventions is there was no way for us to pass arguments using the vector registers. There was no way for us to say, oh, I have this, you know, for example, 256-bit vector element. There was no way for us to say, okay, just pass that via the SSE2 registers. So we added this new vector call calling convention, which allows us to keep vector data in these vector units as much as possible. So this allows us to get rid of a lot of unnecessary copying to the stack and then copying back into the registers that would happen across function calls. We have this library. I don't know. Has anybody heard of C++ AMP? Awesome. That is really good to hear. So for those who haven't, C++ AMP, AMP stands for Accelerated Massive Parallelism. It's basically a library that enables you to write basically in a subset of C++, and it's a very large subset, so it's actually most of C++, code that we can then compile and execute on the GPU. So, for example, you know, if you're doing matrix multiplication or any kind of heavy math code, you can very easily run that code on the GPU. So the first release of this was in Visual Studio 2012. We had a whole bunch of functionality there, and we've made a bunch of improvements in the new release, especially around performance and to reduce copying between the graphics memory and main memory in the system. So these, you know, as time goes by, Intel and AMD continue adding new sets of instructions to their CPUs. The latest set is AVX2 and also FMA. So AVX2 is the Advanced Vector Extensions 2 that supersedes improves upon AVX. They are brand new in Intel's Haswell architecture, which came out, I believe, middle of last year or sometime around then. AMD has yet to come out with any AVX2 capable CPUs. So in the Visual Studio 2013 Update 2 that we're, I think, about to RTM, we've added new support for the compiler can actually generate AVX2 instructions and optimize code to run on using the AVX2 unit. There's a special architecture option for this because if you do compile using this option, then your program won't run on CPUs that don't support AVX2. So, you know, there's certainly benefits to doing this if you know that you're only going to be running on that restricted class of machines that supports this. For the FMA, the Fuse Multiply Add, we actually made substantial improvements to the math library in the C runtime for Visual Studio 2013. And so if your CPU has FMA capability, we'll take advantage of it. Otherwise, we'll fall back to the older implementation that used SSE2 or other units on the CPU. And some of these have led to, you know, some of these have substantial performance improvements, like, you know, 20-30% of some of the most commonly called math functions like sine and cosine. So not only have we improved the performance of the code that we generate, we've also, you know, worked to improve the performance of the compiler because, as everybody knows, C++ compilation is a rather slow process. So two of the major improvements that we've made this release is we discovered that there were a bunch of bottlenecks when basically the compiler was writing to PDB files, program database, the debug information files. And so we were able to make about a 10% performance improvement, you know, just by making fixes there. We also found that our header file lookup was doing a lot of extra I/O that was not actually required. So there's not a substantial benefit here on, you know, small like laptop or workstation class machines, but on build server class machines where you might have 40 cores, you know, pulling data off SSDs, there can be a massive improvement to compile time here. Because we're able to do less I/O. So that's kind of the bulk of the performance improvements that we've made in the last release. So let's take a look at some of the language improvements. So, you know, turning from the compiler backend to the compiler frontend and looking at some of the C++ 11 features. So just out of curiosity, how many people here are already using a bunch of C++ 11 in their code today? Okay. That's good that there's a few people. So for those who don't know, perhaps, you know, C++ is an evolving language. There's a standardization process that we're continuing to try and, you know, add new features to the language. I think that the way it was best phrased by someone I follow on Twitter was that, or no, it was someone, it was at a talk at C++ Now a couple years ago that, you know, in order to make the language simpler, we added a bunch of stuff to it. You know, with the idea being that, oh, now that we've added these new things that make things a lot easier, people can stop using the older, cruftier parts of C++ that, you know, give it, you know, a reputation for complexity. So, you know, we've already implemented a large part of the new language features that were added in C++ 11, and we're continuing to add more. GCC and Clang are also continuing to implement these. So these are features that, you know, soon should be available, you know, across basically all modern compilers. So in Visual C++ 2013, we've added a bunch of new features. So the features in both of the first two columns, I borrowed this chart from another presentation, so they should probably just be grouped together. And we'll look at each of those, you know, in detail to show, you know, what some of these new features enable us to do in C++ code. But we didn't stop there. We also, in right about the same time that we RTM'd Visual Studio 2013, we also released a CTP of basically a preview of the compiler with a whole bunch of other features supported here. And it's not all of these. We don't support user-defined literals or the C++ 14 library stuff in the CTP, but we do have preliminary support for the rest of it. So it's you know, if you're interested in playing with that, you can go search for the CTP and download it and play with it. It does not have a Go Live license, so you can't use it for, you know, actually building and, you know, distributing your code. But certainly if you want to play with the new language features and be able to report bugs back to us before we release the final product, that's always certainly appreciated. So, you know, in addition to all of those, you know, we're still actively working on, you know, the remaining features. These are basically the rest of the C++11 and some of the C++14 features. And I know that I've seen, you know, some of these already get, support for some of these already get checked in. So, you know, we're actively working to finish these. Ah, there we go. So, yes, we've just not done those last two. So I want to look through, you know, each of those C++11 features in brief and kind of talk through, you know, why they're important and where they benefit code. So to start with explicit conversion operators. So prior to these being added, there was this hole in the C++ type system where if you had, and it was specifically noticeable with operator bool. So if you had a type and you wanted it to be testable as a Boolean, so for example, if you have a smart pointer type and you want to be able to test it in if condition like an ordinary pointer, you know, to test whether it's null, you'd want to implement an operator bool. But there was this problem that then if you implemented that operator bool and then you tried to compare two smart pointers, the compiler would say, well, hey, I can convert one to bool and I can convert the other one to bool. So it would just call the Boolean conversions and compare them. So as long as both were not null, they would both compare equal. And that is not at all what you want with equality comparisons for pointers. So C++11 adds this new feature, explicit conversion operator. So you can mark the conversion as explicit, which means that it can't be used in that previous context. So it can only be used in cases where you explicitly ask for, whatever the type is. So that can be through a cast. So if you do a static cast to that type, for Boolean in particular, it can be if you use it, you know, as an if test or, you know, in a loop test. But you can't use it in the incorrect context. So raw string literals are especially useful with the, I wish I had examples in here, but they're especially useful with the new regex library in Visual C++. So prior to these being added, you know, if you wanted to add quotes to your string, you would need to, you know, escape the quotes. With raw string literals, you don't have to. Basically, you can mark the string and say, hey, you know, just treat this as whatever's in there, and the compiler would not do any escaping of the characters. So this is useful if you've got quotes in there, or if you have a lot of quotes in there, or perhaps some backslashes. Or even if you want to, you know, define a multi-lined string literal, you can do that without, yes, this is a very useful feature. So another feature that was added is default function template arguments. So class templates have had this feature for a long time, that if you have a template argument, you can say, all right, I'll give it this, you know, default argument. So for example, here, this is the declaration of std vector. You know, for the allocator, we say, we'll just default to using the std allocator, the default allocator. And what this does is it means that when you just say vector of int, you know, that's the same as saying a vector of int with the standard allocator. But there's no way to do this for function templates. So for example, if we wanted to write, you know, a sort function template, and we wanted to make, you know, the default predicate be less, so it, you know, sorts them into lexicographic order, then there was no way to specify that. Commonly, you know, people might try, and I know I tried this many times, and every time I said, oh, that doesn't work, of just adding a default argument here. But the compiler will not deduce template arguments from function default function arguments. So that doesn't work. Generally, the workaround solution was just to do two overloads of the function template. So, you know, for this example, we would just have an overload that takes the container and then passes it into the other algorithm with the desired comparer. So in C++11, we just make this a bit easier, and we say, hey, we can now specify a default template argument. There's no real technical reason why this wasn't possible before. It just wasn't allowed. So another useful feature, and if you've ever worked with C#, I know C# has this feature, is delegating constructors. So in this particular case, we have two constructors, and they both, you know, they both initialize a few members, and then they go and call, you know, they have this same loop in them. And oftentimes, the way that we deal with this is rather than duplicating the code, because we never want to copy and paste code, is we move this into some kind of initialization function. And that's not ideal, because really we don't want to be, you know delegating initialization to a whole, you know, other functions other than constructors. So C++ 11 adds this new feature called delegating constructors, where you can have one constructor delegate to another one. So here, you know, instead of initializing A, B, and C directly and then, you know, going through the whole loop initialization for that first constructor, it just delegates to the second constructor. So it just says, you know, as if the user had called this one. So this is really useful for classes that have a whole bunch of constructors, you know, that, you know, delegate to each other or, you know, take different kinds of arguments, and then you can have one that takes all of them that you can pass in the defaults. So another feature that is somewhat useful is uniform initialization. So prior to this feature being added, there were basically two ways to do object initialization in C++. You know, you could either do int x equals 0 or, you know, int y and then with parentheses. So the parentheses form was usually used for class types, you know, when you wanted to invoke a constructor, and then the equals form has been used elsewhere, mostly for legacy reasons that people got used to that with C, and then they, you know, propagated through coding standards. So C++ 11 adds this new form with braces. And, you know, the reason for using a new punctuator is it allows them to, you know, come up with new rules without having to worry about backward compatibility, because it's, you know, it's brand new. So I think that the best way to show why this is useful is, let's say that you have a template. And in that template, you have an object of type X. And all we want to do is, you know, we want to default initialize this. We want to value initialize it. So if it's an int, we want it to have the value 0. If it's a class type with a constructor, we want it, you know, we want that default constructor to be called. If it's a class type without any constructors, we want, you know, it's all of its members to be value initialized. So in C++ 03, you know, prior to C++ 11, this was not easy. So, you know, first we might try using copy initialization like the first line, but this doesn't work for some class types that have an explicit copy constructor. The second line, of course, doesn't work because it's a function declaration. The third line, again, is a function declaration, and this is commonly referred to as the most vexing parse in C++. And the fourth line actually does work, but that's an awful lot of parentheses, and having to write that is kind of painful, and certainly painful to read. So in C++ 11 with uniform initialization, it's easy. You just give it two braces, and that means value initialize this thing. So this is one case absolutely where uniform initialization is really useful. For any local variables, you know, if you're like, oh, I don't know, you know, what value this should have yet, you know, at least giving it the value initialization like this is a definite improvement. So this brace form of initialization can be used elsewhere as well. I think I've been using it in previous slides, that when you're initializing data members, you can use it to initialize data members. It has a couple of other benefits. So one of them is it doesn't allow narrowing conversions. So for example, if we had a variable of declared type int and we tried to initialize it with an expression of type double, the compiler would reject that because it's a narrowing conversion that loses information. It's somewhat useful. It can be tricky, though, if you're working in code that uses, for example, any type that's smaller than int. Because most expressions get promoted to int in order to be evaluated, so you end up with some casts that you might not have otherwise needed. So the one case that you'll need to watch out for is that the brace initialization does not play nicely with auto. So if you're using the auto feature, which I'm not going to discuss in this presentation because we've had it since Visual Studio 2010, basically, in this particular instance, X gets deduced to be an initializer list with a single element rather than being an int. This is widely considered to be a major design snafu, and I know that the C++ Language Standards Committee is actively considering changing this to make this actually so that x would be an int, because basically nobody who writes this expects that to be an initializer list. And it's kind of disappointing that two of the, you know, the top featured language features of C++11 don't work well together. So this isn't the only way that braces are used, though. So the other case where they're useful is as initializer lists. So we can start off with the basic problem of, you know, okay, we have a vector. How do we initialize it to contain the values 1 through 10? So, you know, one way would be to, you know, initialize it and to resize it and then go write a loop to initialize it. And I realize now that it actually has the values 0 through 9, but that's okay. Another way that people commonly do is they'll have a local array, and then they'll go and, you know, copy the elements into the vector from the local array. And that also works, but both of these are quite verbose. We certainly, you know, don't want to have to write all this. So now with initializer list, you can actually just directly initialize your container. So for example, for vector, you can give it a set of elements, and it'll go and initialize it. For the containers in particular, you do have to be a bit careful, especially with the int type, because there's already some constructors that take, like, you know, a couple of integer values. But generally, this works very well, and it's a very neat and clean solution. It also works for maps. So, for example, if we have a map from int to int, we can initialize it with pairs. And note that we don't have to name any of the types. The compiler automatically deduces, you know, what types are needed from the type being initialized. So variadic templates are mostly useful for library developers. So in this example here, you know, we've got this function f, and we want it to be able to take, you know, anywhere from 0 to maybe 10 arguments, and we want to, you know, be able to retain type information. So we don't want to use, you know, C-style varargs functions because, you know, there's no type of information associated with the arguments there. So the way that we'd typically do this before is, you know, we'd write 10 different overloads that take, you know, 0 arguments, 1 argument, 2 argument, 3 argument, and we'd implement all of them. This is what we did in the standard library because there's a bunch of functions in the standard library that need to support, you know, and basically an unbounded number of arguments. And so we emulated that, and we said that, you know, our unlimited number of arguments was 10. And so we basically wrote, well, we had these rather complex macros that would go and spam out these function definitions. So with C++11, this becomes all much easier because you can just use ellipses, and now this particular function will take from 0 to n arguments. It can be a bit tricky working with variadic templates because there's no, you can't iterate over the arguments. You have to use recursion, which is common with template metaprogramming. This feature is not so useful for application code, but it's very useful for library code, like in the standard library. The reason why you may care about this particular feature is that because we've been able to rip out all of that macro machinery from the standard library headers, so we no longer have to spam out all those declarations, we just need to have the correct declaration, your precompiled header files, if you're using precompiled headers, are much smaller because there's a lot fewer declarations in them, and compilation times are somewhat faster because of this. So another useful feature is related to the delegating constructors, perhaps, is the ability to initialize non-static data members inline. So for example, in this case, you know, we always initialize you know, these x, y, and z local variables to the same value in both constructors. So it'd be really nice if we could just, you know, initialize them inline in the class definition. And so you can actually do that in C++11. It works for, I've used ints here, but it works for any type. You can still, in your constructor, you can still initialize them, in which case that'll take precedence, but otherwise this is used as a fallback default. So, you know, this could be especially useful for if you have, you know, int data members and, you know, you want to make sure that they're always zero initialized, you know, you can just make sure that they're zero initialized in the class definition. So there's two features that are related to each other. One of them is delete. So, you know, in C++03, if you wanted to declare that, or if you wanted to make a class non-copyable, so you don't want people to make be able to make copies of instances of your class, you'd declare the copy constructor and copy assignment operator as private, and you just wouldn't implement them. So either you would get a compilation error, because they're inaccessible, or if you happen to try to make a copy, you know, with it from within a friend class or from, you know, within a member function of this class itself, you wouldn't get a compilation error, but you would get a link error later, which, you know, could be then hard to track down to figure out where, you know, you were actually making that copy. So in C++ 11, you can now mark special member functions as deleted. So you can say delete this, and what this does is it removes that that function from overload resolution. So if you try to call that function, it's a hard error at compile time. So this is mostly useful in this case for improving improving diagnostics when you try to misuse a non-copyable type. There's other cases where this is useful too. So you can actually mark any overload of any function as deleted. So for example, if you want, you know, a function to be callable, you know, only with particular types of arguments, then you could, you know, for example, if you want something to be callable with int but not with double, and you don't want to allow conversions, then you could make the double overload deleted. Similar to this, you can also make functions defaulted. So what this does is, you know, for example, if you were to declare that first constructor of, you know, our class taking, you know, with a constructor taking an int, you would also then have to declare and define the default constructor, because anytime you declare one constructor, the default constructor is suppressed if you don't define it yourself. So now you can define that as defaulted. You can also do this with the destructor or with other special member functions. This is mostly useful, not necessarily for constructors, because the default constructor is fairly straightforward. Though there's cases in the language where you need to have a trivial constructor, in which case the user-defined version that we had on the previous slide, that's not trivial, but the defaulted one is, because it's provided by the compiler, or it may be at least. It's useful for destructors if you want to have if you want to default the constructor or the destructor. And it's also useful for, say, you need to customize you know, one or more of the copy or move operations, but not all of them. Then you can default the ones that you don't need to customize. This has been one of my favorite features, which came as a surprise to me, because when I first saw it, I thought it was kind of silly. But as I've used it more, I found that it's helped make my code a lot cleaner. So this again is the declaration of std vector, and, you know, it defaults to using the std allocator. Let's say that we have our own allocator, my allocator, and I want to use that throughout my code base instead of, you know, the standard allocator. Maybe it's specially optimized for types of work that I'm doing, or maybe it has, you know, different levels of, you know, caching for objects, or, you know, whatever it does. So, you know, we could go and we could write out, you know, vector, and we could, you know, specifically use, you know, my allocator throughout here. This becomes a bit of a maintenance problem, though, because then if we want to go and change that out later, or, you know, see, oh, how do things perform with the standard allocator compared to this, you know, there's no easy way for us to swap that out. So one thing that was done previously is, because you can't typedef a template, right? There's no way to define a typedef for a template. So what you do is you'd wrap in a struct, and you'd have a nested typedef. So, you know, in this case, we could say my vector of int and then the nested type, and that would fill in my allocator as appropriate. So in C++ 11, there's a new feature called a using alias, and this is actually this particular kind of it is called an alias template. And so it allows you to actually define an alias for a template with particular arguments. So in this case, my vector of t is a vector of t using my allocator. So using aliases are also usable for general typedefs. So for example, you know, instead of doing typedef int integer type, we can do using integer type equals int. That may not look useful, but it is really useful for function types or function pointer types in this case. So before, you'd have to go and hunt for where you put the type, you know, with along with the asterisk and figure out which side it goes on. And now the whole type gets grouped together all on one side, and the name is separate. So it makes it not only a bit easier to write, but also it makes it easier to write your code in columns if you want, so you can, you know, have all your type defs in one column and then the types that they're defined to be in the other. So those are all the C++ features. But we've also had ongoing requests to implement C features. So the compiler currently supports basically all of C90. And we've elected not to implement most of C99, largely because we'd really prefer that people move to C++. However, there are a lot of open source projects out there. There's a lot of projects for other systems that use these C99 features because they're available on their platforms. And we'd like to make it easier to bring those to Windows. So we have implemented some of the most frequently used C99 features. We've actually supported a few things for a while. Notably, in the preprocessor, we support variadic macros, so you can have macros that take any number of arguments. But for this release in particular, we decided to go and implement a few things that projects tend to use most frequently. So the first of those is the ability to mix declarations and statements. So if we're writing code, and it's best to try and declare variables as close to their first use as possible. But in C90, this is not allowed. You had to group all of your declarations at the top of a block and then follow that with all of your statements. So you ended up with code that looked a lot like this, but if you had a really long function, you might have 30 or 40 local variables at the top. So in C99, you have the ability to mix them now, and so now this is valid C code, and the compiler will accept it. C also did not have a bool type before C99, so we've implemented the bool type. It's not the type name with all underscores or all lowercase letters. Bool is not actually a primitive type in C. There's a compiler-provided type, underscore capital B bool, and then you have to include the stdbool.h header in order to use bool. This was done by the C committee, I expect, for backward compatibility with code bases that use a macro for bool or something along those lines. So this is just a small thing that makes some C code a bit cleaner and easier to work with. This is a feature that is available only in C, so if you try to do this in C++, it won't work because it's not part of the C++ language. And that is, when you're initializing a struct, you can actually now specify which member you're initializing, which is really useful if you have a struct with a lot of members and you don't want to have to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yes, this is the 15th member that I want to change. We've also added support for C99 compound literals, which is also not supported in C++, though we don't really need them because you can just construct types on the fly or using brace initialization. So with this, if this function f takes an s struct, then we want to call it. This is as if we were to declare a local s struct with some compiler internal name and then call the function with that. So the reason that we picked these features in particular was to enable FFmpeg to compile on our platform. So the FFmpeg library is used for video encoding and decoding by a lot of popular apps. So by enabling these features, this was our target library that we said, hey, let's go and see what we can do to enable this library as a sample library. A lot of other libraries are enabled by these features. We're still looking at what other features from C99 may be useful. My understanding is that even today there is no full implementation of the C99 standard, that there are some arcane features that like even GCC and other compiler tool chains have chosen not to implement for one reason or another. So we're still doing some investigation. There's still a few big things missing. One of them that is used somewhat frequently is variable length arrays, so where you can have a function, for example, that takes a size as a parameter, and then you can declare an array using that size, so it's not a fixed size. That feature was actually made optional later in C11, largely because people have realized that this is a huge opportunity for security bugs where, you fail to check the size that was passed in and then you overrun the stack. So that's all for compiler features. We'll take a look at some of the libraries work that we've done. So I'm a member of the libraries team, so I can I know a lot about most of what we did for the last release. We did a ton of work in the C++ standard library. Most of that work was to take advantage of all of those new compiler features that we looked at. So every time a new compiler feature is implemented, we have to go and fix bugs in our standard library implementation. We have to remove workarounds that we had in place to work around the lack of compiler support. And then we have to go and implement new features that required that compiler support to begin with. So some of those, and specifically variadic templates, have enabled us to make major improvements to compile times of things that include like all of the standard library headers, which turn out to be a lot of projects. We've also made many bug fixes. I don't have a count for the STL. I have a count for some of the other libraries, but it's in the hundreds. We also implemented, so in C++ 03, everything was all really happy. So if you wanted to have a vector of t, t had to be copyable and assignable. So there was no option there. It had to meet those two requirements, and so we took advantage of that all over the containers library. In C++ 11, though, since we now have move semantics, we'd really like to be able to have containers of move-only types or containers of types that aren't assignable at all. So basically, the requirements on that type T have been made much more fine-grained. So each individual operation on a vector, like pushback, has specific requirements, and assign has specific requirements on the type. So we went through and audited our containers implementation, and there's probably a few lagging bugs still, but we have a fairly comprehensive test suite that we use to verify that we now meet those requirements. There were probably 60 or 70 bugs that we found just by writing that test suite. Most of them were arcane corner cases that no one is ever going to run into, but it was still useful to fix them. We've actually implemented a few of our first C++ 14 library features. So C++ 11 is done, and the next revision of C++ should be C++ 14. It's in its final draft state. There was a meeting in Issaquah, Washington, earlier this year, where basically all the last work went into it. And assuming it gets approved, then that'll be the next version. It's mostly a bug fix release, but we've implemented a few of the library features. Improved some of the performance in Atomic, and then we've updated some of the type traits to fix issues. So in the C standard library, in addition to doing all of the compiler work to add some C99 features, we're working to finish up implementing all of the C99 library functionality in the C standard library. This is not only important to enable C projects to compile, but it's also important because C++ 11 incorporates, by reference, the C99 standard library. So in order to have full C++ conformance, we have to implement all this functionality. So for the last release, we implemented most of the leafy things, the things that we could change without making major infrastructure changes to the runtime libraries. So these include a whole bunch of new math functions, a handful of new I/O functions. There's still a handful of features that we haven't implemented. Notably, there's new printf, scanf length modifiers for example, size t and int max t that we don't support. We don't support the sn printf and snw printf functions. And then there's a handful of bugs that we still have to work out. Actually, we've already implemented all of these for the next release. So we're not quite done, but at least the things on the slide we're done with. So, related to the STL, there's new work ongoing, and it's not just Microsoft. It's there's two other companies. I think NVIDIA, and I've forgotten who the third company is, working on basically an updated version of the STL that supports parallelism. So, for example, a sort algorithm, like shown here on the screen, that can run in parallel and take advantage of multiple threads, or potentially run on a GPU for some algorithms, if that makes sense. So the reason that we can't just make std sort parallel is the operator less than for your type or whatever comparer you're using there might not be pure. It might actually go and modify global state or touch things. It might not be thread safe. One would hope not, but it's possible. So these are being implemented as a new set of algorithms. And in this case, it takes a par parameter to say to run this in parallel. I wasn't actually going to talk about this today because I didn't have anything to talk about it, but we announced on our blog today that we've released an initial prototype of this. It is open source under the Apache license, so you can go and take a look at it on CodePlex and give feedback. It's still so the technical specification isn't complete yet, so this is an implementation of what we know so far, and there's still negotiations and arguments about what the final product should look like. But certainly, if you're interested in parallelism, definitely take a look. So turning from the ultra new to the not so new, We made some changes to ATL and MFC, not a whole lot of new feature work. Mostly, you know, these libraries are in maintenance, so we're not really adding a whole lot of new functionality. For ATL, the biggest change was that we've removed the ATL DLL completely, so there's no more DLL form of ATL. All of the code is now static, and we've reduced a lot of the dependencies. So instead of, you know, we used to have debug and release static libraries, and we used to have Unicode and ANSI static libraries, and now we just have one static library, and everything else is in header-only code. So not only has this made the library easier for us to maintain, so it's a lower maintenance burden, but it's also improved usability for customer code. The main big change that we made to MFC was we've deprecated support for multi-byte character set versions of it. So our recommendation is for customers to start moving their code to Unicode if they're still using MFC. At least for this release, we have provided, you know, the old multi-byte libraries available for download, but they're separate. So, you know, if you try and compile your program, it's not going to work the first time. So we fixed 105 bugs in MFC and then 60 ATL bugs. So then turning back to new stuff, we have this library, Casablanca. I don't know if anybody here has heard of Casablanca. All right, so its official name is now the C++ REST SDK, but it was codenamed Casablanca while it was in development. So this is a library that our team works on. For enabling you to write C++ code that works with cloud services, so specifically cloud services that provide REST APIs. Azure provides these other, you know, most, you know, web APIs, many web APIs use this form. So it provides a whole bunch of functionality. It's also open source under the Apache license, I assume. And we currently have it building for Windows, OS X, iOS, Linux, so you know, our goal is not only to make it possible to build software that runs on Windows, but also, you know, to build software that runs on Windows and also other platforms. You know, one of the primary benefits of C++ is it's portable. You know, it runs almost everywhere. And so, you know, we're hoping to continue to enable that. And so it has a number of pieces. So finally, this is kind of half libraries, half IDE stuff. There's this new feature in Visual Studio called NuGet. I don't know, has anybody used NuGet before? All right. I wasn't sure what to think of this, you know, when I first started hearing about it and people telling me about it, but then I actually went and used it to install the C++ REST SDK. So if you search for Casablanca, you can find it there. I think the best way to describe this is, you know, prior to NuGet, you know, if you get a new library and then you'd have to go and compile it, and then you have to go and take your project and update all of your include directories and your library directories and add your library dependencies. So NuGet encapsulates all that. So literally, it's one click to go and download the binary copy of the library and, you know, hook up your projects that you can build with it. So it's you know, it's definitely an improvement over the old model. So finally, we'll take a look. You know, we don't just work on, you know, runtime components and build time components. We also own all of the IDE experience for C++ developers. So we've made a whole bunch of improvements here. This is a list of them, but it's probably easiest. I'm just going to show a demo of some of these features. All right. So first, we've added, if I can find my mouse. We've added a whole bunch of new formatting features. So these are all new in the new release. We used to have, you know, a handful of things, but now, you know, we can do auto formatting, and it's very highly customizable. So you can customize, you know, exactly how statements get indented, where your braces go, you know, even like, you know, where the access specifiers are. I think it's really nice that this dialog, it also shows, you know, what the code will actually look like when it does the formatting based on your options. So, you know, there's many dozens of options in here, which is good because every code base has its own coding style. The good news is if you don't like the IDE messing with your code, if you like to just, you know, write it and format it yourself, which I do because I'm very picky, you can. It's very easy to just disable it and tell it stop. Don't touch my code. But I've left it all enabled in the IDE for now to show off a few of the features. Oh, I forgot the first feature. This was widely requested. This dialogue is now resizable, which I am told was an enormous amount of work, and I'm not a UI programmer, but I'm very happy that it's resizable. One other thing that's useful is, you'll see this box up here in the corner. It says Quick Launch, Control-Q. So if I type Control-Q and then start typing, so I've typed C++ formatting, it's actually got links to all of those formatting pages. So it'll actually take you right where you want to go. Or if I were to go fonts and colors, or just fonts probably, it'll have a link to that. So oftentimes, that dialog, it's got that tree view and it's got hundreds of pages in it and it's really hard to find things. So this can make it really easy to go and navigate, to find exactly the settings you want to change. So if we look at some of the new IDE stuff that's been done, one thing is we now do brace completion. So for example, if I type a curly brace, it'll automatically put in the matching curly brace, and then if I type the matching one in, it'll automatically type over it, so you don't get two of them. This also works for parentheses and braces. In addition to that, if you're defining a class type, not only does it fill in the braces for you, but it also adds the semicolon, which is nice because I don't know how many. I'm sure everybody in this room has defined a class type and forgotten that, and then the compiler, of course, is like, "Oh, what are you doing?" So another thing we've done. So up here, I've got just this simple class type, and it's got a few member functions. And in here, we have an instance of it. So if I just go and get the members for it, you'll note that it has the nested function, the public function, the return function, because all those are public. It does not show the private function because the private function is inaccessible in this context. You can undo that filtering. I think it's Control J, and it'll show you all of them if you want. But if we were then to go, up here into one of these member functions and we go get the list, it would show up there by default because it is accessible in that context. So, we've now made this context-based, which is quite useful. Another thing that we've done is we've updated the... Whoops. It's very hard to type and look at this screen. I can't see it on the here. We show this quick info, this quick help for parameters. Now, if you have a nested function call, we'll actually switch and show you the parameter information for the next nested function call, which we didn't used to do. In addition, as you start filling in parameters, it'll update to what the current best match is. So in this case, it's 1, and then if we were to type a comma, it'll show you here's the 2-parameter version. So this is definitely helpful if you're, working with large APIs that you're not familiar with. Another feature that people have often asked for, so I have in this project, there's source.cpp and source.h. We have a feature, it's Control-K-O is the default, to toggle between them. So this is really useful if, you're adding a declaration and then you want to go back to your source code and, tweak the definition or what have you. So people have been asking for this for a long time, and now we've implemented it. One feature that is not new but is substantially improved is has anybody used the control comma dialog? Yeah, so in Visual Studio 2012, you could type control comma and you could search and it would show you you could search for any string and it would give you files that match. It would give you classes, member functions. Basically, it would find all of the things that match. And it's really great for being able to easily navigate around a large code base because you can just search for something and boom, it'll get you there. But it was a modal dialog. So, you'd have to click, you'd have to select one and then get to the file and you're like, oh, that's not the one I wanted. So now it's not modal. It's actually in here. So in this case, if I search for my class, it shows me both the class and also the constructor. And as I, scroll between the items, it actually switches the context. If the declarations and definitions were in different in different files, and it would show two entries, one for the declaration, one for the definition, and you know, you could switch between those as well. Let's see here. One last thing is if I open the project properties dialog, it shows up on the other monitor. This dialog is also resizable. So, you know, if you have a lot of define macros or include paths, very useful. So, there were a few things that I guess I didn't show. You can use Alt up and down now to move lines around. I don't really know why this would be useful, but it is there. People use that. We have in Visual Studio 2012, there was a new feature added called NatViz. So what this is it's an actual extensibility point for being able to define your own visualizers for native types, so for the debugger to take advantage of. So we've made a whole bunch of advancements here. If you just search for NatViz on Bing or Google, you can find all sorts of examples and information. But really, with a very small amount of XML, you can make your types much more easily readable in the debugger. You can have it, display specific members. You can have it, when you have an object only as one line, you can have it, display a string containing, particular information about that object that you care about. So we talked about code formatting. There's no improvements here in Visual Studio 2013, but I do want to mention it because the default editor schemes don't really do a good job of showing this off. But if you go into the Fonts and Colors dialog, you can actually customize the colors of basically every element in C++. And if you do that, so this is my editor colors that I use at work, you can actually change the colors of types. So, class types can have a specific color. You can have a color for static member functions that's distinct from, non-static member functions. So you can see here that my class is colored differently when it's a constructor than when it's used as a type. You can have enumerators be colored a certain thing. So, by customizing this, yes, my code looks very colorful.
Can you download this?
This color scheme?
Yeah.
No, but I'd be happy to give it to you. It's just on my laptop. I'll give you my card if you want. But, I found that by doing this, it makes it much easier to go and, figure out what's going on in the code. Because you can figure out, that's constructing a type, that's, calling a function, that's, where's that constant coming from? Oh, it's a macro. The other advantage here, and, there's a lot of small advantages, but one of them is if you're in a CPP file and you mistype the declaration of a member function that's defined in the, or that's declared in the header, it'll show up, in your static member function color because the compiler's like, oh, I couldn't match it to an actual member function. And so then, you get an immediate, I need to go fix something. We've also made a bunch of performance improvements. So this is the difference between Visual Studio 2012 and 2013 of switching between solution configurations. So for example, between debug and release. So the first time switch, is still a bit slow, but okay, it's the first time, maybe that's not a big deal. But we've improved it from, in this extremely large solution, from 170 seconds to 40 seconds. And then our subsequent switches, we've gone from 100 seconds to half of a second, which I think is much more important than that first time. So this has, I know that in the hobby project that I work on where I use Visual Studio, this has been a huge improvement. We're also actively working on some refactoring tools, so there's none included in Box with Visual Studio, but we did release shortly after RTM an extension that provides rename refactoring. So you can right-click a name in the editor and then select refactor and rename, and any uses that the compiler can determine for sure, are uses of that name, it'll go and change, and then it'll give you a list of all the things where they might be that name, but it's not sure, and so you have to go and fix them up. So this is, a major productivity benefit. We'd certainly love for you to download this and try it out and give us feedback. If you want more features like this, let us know, and we'll know to spend time working on that. So that's all I have for new features. I just want to mention, finally, that our team really loves talking with you, our customers and developers. We have a blog, so there's a whole bunch of articles out there on covering a lot of this material. You can find me on Twitter. You can find our team on Twitter, on Facebook, on MSDN. Most importantly, though, if you find bugs in the product, if you find that, you know, something doesn't work correctly, please, please, please report bugs. Because if you don't report it, the chance of us fixing it is practically zero, because we're not going to know about it. I know that on our on the libraries team, you know, we triage bugs weekly. You know, we can't always reply, you know, immediately, but we do look at every bug. We try to fix as many as possible. You know, if there's little things, maybe we don't get to it. But you know, if there's major issues like these are high priority. We take customer reported bugs very seriously, so you know, we'd love to have your guys' feedback. So with that, that's all I have. Are there any questions? There are no questions.
Maybe something about the performance of the compiler in comparison to Clang or other compilers. Visual Studio is quite slow.
I actually, I don't know. So I mean, perhaps it is. I admit that in my day-to-day work, I don't use other tool chains, so it's hard to say. I can tell you that we are actively doing major performance work. We have a whole team of people right now that are working to improve the compile times. Certainly, if compile times are slow to you, you can imagine that, you know, in the Windows Build Lab, when we build Windows every night, it's, you know,
yeah.
They yeah. So yes, we feel your pain. Yes. Of course, now with native.NET, they're going to get C++ compile times. All right.
About CLI, did that change very much?
C++, yes. There are not many major changes. I think that we've improved some of the interop with C++ 11 features. So, for example, I think that in Visual Studio 2010 or 2012, for example, you could not mix, you could not use move-only types with C++ CLI, and now I believe that you can. I'm not entirely sure on that. In general, we're still recommending C++ CLI only for, you know, interop scenarios, so, you know, wrapping you know, actual native code for use in managed applications. Though we're well aware that, you know, there are people with large Windows Forms code bases written in C++ CLI, so, you know, we're certainly still maintaining it for that. All right. Well, feel free to ask me any questions after the session, and thank you for coming.